Okay, so today we're talking about the last two principles of faith, which are the coming of the Messiah and resurrection. So in case, I'm sure I think everybody heard in the room, but unfortunately my sick granddaughter passed away, and the other one had a little scare, threw us for a loop, but she's doing well now. Thank God. She's still in the hospital, still in the NICU, but she's doing great. She got a few blood transfusions, hematocrit is up, oxygen is down. All she has to do is wake up enough to eat a full meal, and she can go home on a regular basis. She's working on it. So it's interesting how learning and teaching... Maybe I didn't turn this one on. Yeah. It's interesting how learning and teaching coincides. And some people even say there is a tradition to not even learn about death and the laws of death unless you're experiencing it. So many people don't learn about it unless they've lost someone, and then they learn the laws, because there is a concept that what you learn about touches your life. So it's interesting to think about, right? So how things move back and forth, right? Because I've often found that what I learn about touches my life, or what's in my life is what I'm learning about, and things seem to move. So it's interesting that this week is the week of learning about resurrection and learning about the Messiah coming. So let's look at the 13 principles first as a group and just chunk them out a little bit. I wish I would have brought, I didn't bring my folder, but the 13 in a row, it's basically, you can divide them into chunks of 5, 4, and 4. Hopefully I'll remember them. Okay. So thank you. I'll look at them. Okay, so the first 5 are about God's existence. So we could see why we need to understand God's existence in order to understand anything else. If you have misconceptions about God's existence, then the rest of everything doesn't work. So God exists. So we have that God is the creator and ruler of all things. We have that he's one. We have that he doesn't have a body. We have that he's first and last, so his eternity. And we have in that group, which we learned separately, number 5 is prayer. It's proper only to relate to God and not to any other power at all. Any other power with a small p, only power with a capital P. All right, so that's the first 5. The second group is 4, and that's really our interaction, how God communicates with us, right? So we have, and I guess you could even make 5. 5 could be with the existence of God, or 5 could be in communication with God, depending on where you put prayer. So it could be on either side of that group. But the next group we'll call 4. So all the words of the prophets are true. Moses is the top prophet. We believe that in the entire Torah that was given through Moses, and that Torah cannot be changed, right? So communication of God to us. So now we have God exists, God communicates with us, and now the last four really come under the heading of it makes a difference. It matters. Everything matters, right? So the first, what we looked at last week, was that God knows, or 2 weeks ago, so that God knows everything and runs the world, so his omniscience and his, what's the other word? Omnipotence, thank you. He knows everything, he runs everything. And that there's reward and punishment, so that there's a dynamic relationship with God, right? So a dynamic relationship so that what we do matters. And then these two fit into that group, so that the Messiah is coming, which we'll talk about in a minute, and that there's resurrection. So these 4 are all about how it matters. So let's look at these 2. So the Messiah is coming. What is that, right? Especially interesting to look at in this season, right? So what is the Messiah concept? It's interesting having a non-Jewish mother who actually works in a church as clergy. So I know they have that. I've seen like a little framed thing that says mirror, mirror on the wall. I am my mother after all. And it's like, how does this happen? Right? And yet, okay. So she... It's an interesting thing because she was talking to me about, I think, her insight, but I would call erroneous insight, but still her insight. Especially after the death of her great-granddaughter, she was able to hold a baby for 2 hours while somebody else was, during the whole service, church service. And she felt so much love, and she said, and for her, a revelation was, oh, this is why God chose to come to the world as a baby. Okay, so I thought that's an interesting thing. That was her thought. So the whole season for them is tied into a principle that we have. So if you think about peace on earth, goodwill towards man, right? So that is a messianic concept. In the end, it's going to be good, right? I don't know if anybody of you saw that movie, The Marigold Hotel, I forgot what it's called. Right, so it's such a great line in there, right? That our sages teach us that in the end, it will all be good. And if it is not good, it is not yet the end. So, so I think that's such a great line, right? I love that. I forgot the name.
It's the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Right, right. It's a really cute movie. It's a total chick flick, but really cute, like, just sweet movie. No offense to the guys who enjoyed it. But it's just a really nice, like, feel-good movie. Very sweet. But that's the line I took from it, which I really liked. In the end, it will all be good, and if it is not good, it is not yet the end, right? So this is the principle of Mashiach. Right? And this is the principle that the Christians are holding on to, is that there's got to be something that's better than this. Right? So, but that's the principle of it matters. What we do matters. What we're right now in a transient stage. This is not it. And anybody who settles into this is it is missing the picture. So that's why the principle, the way Maimonides expresses it, is I believe with perfect faith that the Messiah will come, and even if he tarries, every day I'll wait for him. Right? So that's the song that we see. That, I mean, it's a Holocaust song. We've sung it throughout the ages at difficult times because we've got, as Jews, we've gone through a lot of hard times, collectively and individually. So we have to know, and it's really a collective thing, because individually it doesn't always work out so great. On an individual, just that person level, in the context of just their life closed, as a closed system, it's not always so great. As part of the entire system, it does. So we have to really connect to the nationhood in this, and that's why all Jews throughout all ages, can't say all Jews, but philosophically, all Jews throughout all ages are waiting for the Messiah on a daily basis. Even though it's only going to be the generation that receives the Messiah that gets to experience the Messiah. And still, it's such a strong principle of faith that even if you're not expecting him around the corner, let's say 1,000 years ago, which they might have been 1,000 years ago, but let's say 1,500 years ago, they probably weren't. It wasn't cataclysmic, right, 1,500 years ago. So maybe they were a little... But you're still expecting every day. So what does that mean, expecting every day? Why are we expecting every day? Why is that such an important principle of faith that we have, that we include it in the 13, that we say you're not really believing Jewish if you don't believe in this? Like, what is that about? So it's about that there is an end goal. There is a destination. There is a purpose of all humanity. And it's all going to be brought to fruition. And maybe we can't do it just by ourselves. You know, we could get very frustrated with Abbas in the UN on the same day that, you know, I mean, he planned, it's amazing to me to look at the Palestinians and think they have won their campaign. They worked for decades. They planned from 1948, to create the concept of Palestinian, to not accept any refugee into any other Arab country, to seal their borders and seal their hearts and seal their pocketbooks, to keep those people pawns for a generation, two, three, to create a PR coup, and they won. They won, right? We didn't. We haven't done it, right? This is something that we, as a Jewish people, nation, have always been bad at. PR for ourselves. Nah, a weak point. You know, it's amazing how smart we are and amazing how bad we are at this. And they did it, right? So they, on the same day that we got the United Nations to vote for our state, that's when they got the non-observer state status. So we could be very dejected, or we could remember Hashem runs the whole world. He runs everything. And in the end, it's going to be good. In the end, there will be vindication. Are you going to say?
But couldn't... I struggle with that a little bit, because can't that somehow foster complacency?
Yes. So that is a problem, which is why we're going to come to resurrection too, and reward and punishment behind this. Right? So there is the individual self that one has to tend to, and their part in the collective whole. So... I mean, just think about thinking as a parable, thinking about education. Okay, so education in this country. The individual is responsible for their own level of education, but especially with a safety net, Anybody could say, you know, whatever, I don't feel like getting educated. I'll get welfare. I'll get Medicare. And I'll, like, whatevs. You know, and I'll have a TV anyway, and I'll have a full belly anyway, you know, and my roof isn't going to leak anyway. The government will give me Section 8, right? So there's the, but your life is not as good as if you work towards what you can, but you, and not only that though, so as a social project, we who try to help forward the government, the thought, whatever it is, of the world, of the country, we understand that mandatory free education is the way to go in this country, and we compel people to go to school to the best of their ability because we want an educated populace. Each person does make a difference, and all those people who become complacent are a drag on society. Not only do they drag, but there are some of them who really could be leading, right? Some of them who really could be discovering, some of them who really could be contributing if they were developed enough. So here they're dragging. They could be middle, just kind of floating, or they could really be leading if they had the right level of education. So as a social project, we do compel people. Think about science. Who needs as much science as we all got, let's say, through high school or even in the beginning of college? Most of us in our lives don't. Middle school science was enough. Right, for most of our lives. But we all get exposed to all that science in case we're one of the creams that rises to the top, that we will be somebody who contributes in the field of science. All of us have to be exposed to that in case we're one of them. Right? So we have this social project of that kind of thing going on. So we do view each one of us as a society as part of the whole and as individuals. So Torah also sees us as part of the whole and as individuals, as part of a nation. In the end, it is going to be good. And you can choose to just ride on the coattails if you want to. But it's not going to be good for you. The nation's still going to get there. That was what Mordecai said to Esther in the palace, right? So when Mordecai went to Esther and said, Esther, you're our ace in the hole. Like, our people is in trouble, and you're Jewish, and you're the queen. How great is that? And you got to go to the king and talk to him. She says, I don't know. The law is you can't go and talk to the king, even if you're the queen. If you haven't been summoned, you can't go. And I haven't been summoned for the last month. I don't know if I can go. Anybody who goes without being summoned, off with their head. And Mordecai says, look, the Jewish people are going to be saved without you. No matter what you do, we have a promise that the Jewish people will last. The only question is, what will your role be in this project? So you get to write the script of your life. For sure, it's going to be good for the Jewish people. But will you be on the bus, off the bus, driving the bus, running behind it? That's up to you, right? You get to pick which role you want to play. But for sure, in the end, it's going to be good for the Jews. No question about it. In the end, it's going to be good for the world. It's not just good for the Jews. Good for the Jews is good for the world. Because our whole job is as the firstborn. Did I mention that in another class? Just that concept? All right, so the first, that's our role. We're called the firstborn, which is interesting. Firstborn in Hebrew is bechor, right? The firstborn boy is a bechor, or if the firstborn is a girl, it's a bechora. But that also sounds like bachar. Right, asher bachar banu mikol hamim, chosen. Bachor is with a, let's see if I can remember my spelling. One's a chet and one's a chaf. I'll just put it that way. They make the same sound. It's two different letters. One means chosen and one means firstborn. It sounds the same, but they are different. But the fact that they sound the same means there's something connected. So what does that mean? We are the firstborn of God. We're not the firstborn of God. We're not the first nation on the planet. There are other nations before us. So what does that mean that we're the firstborn? We function as the firstborn. So I'm the firstborn in my family, but there's only two of us, so I don't have this role as much. But if there's a larger family, the firstborn's job is to be, in a way, the mini parent, to function as the liaison between parent and the rest of the kids. They sometimes take on too much. Right, and the parent has to remind them, you be the child, I'll be the parent, right? And on the one hand, there's that, and on the other hand, the parent often relies on them quite a bit. Can you watch the kids while I? Will you put supper on the table while I? Will you take care of this? Well, you know, whatever it is, there is that reliance. There's a very close relationship between parent and firstborn. Maybe not more love, sometimes more love, but maybe not. But certainly more of an alliance, hopefully. They're your helper, more than other kids are the helper. And it's their job to try to convey the will of the parents to the other children and bring them into line a little bit. So that's our job. It's not that we're the firstborn, but it's our role, firstborn. It's our job to be the special helper of our parent in heaven and to relate to the other children, all the other nations on the planet. It's our job to be the example, to set the example, to set the tone, to communicate the wishes of the parent to the other kids. That's our job, right? So, and we can choose where we want to be in that job. It's a wide spectrum. We're a whole nation. So within our whole nation, some of us will be slackers and some of us will be leaders. Some of us will be prison guards and some of us will be prisoners. Some of us will be guardsmen and some of us will be lawyers and some of us will be bankers and some of us will be whatever it is, all kinds of different things. Some will be educators and some will be scientists and some will be doctors and some will be computer hackers, you know, like whatever, right? So there's different people that pull in different directions, but it's all one nation. And we are one body, and hopefully we get ourselves to a place where, as a body, we first of all feel like a body, but we second of all work together as an organism to shine the light in the world that shows the rest of the peoples of the world. There's many ways to be in relationship with God. And we all are shining examples of it, and we're shining examples of a community of people who do it. It's not just one way. It's not just in the study hall, and it's not just in the operating theater, it's not just in the sports arena, but it's in all of them. There's lots of different ways, and we are the examples of that. So that's our role as firstborn. But as you see, we've been working on this project now for the last 3,000 years, basically, and we haven't fully achieved it. So it turns out we need some help. And that's what Mashiach is about. 100% human being who will be a charismatic leader that will help coalesce all the energy and bring us to the place we need to go.
What is the Torah basis, or what is the basis of, you know, messianic thought in Judaism?
So it's not so much in the five books. It's really in the later prophets, which is why we point back to the other principles of how God communicates with us. We believe the words of the prophets are true. Right, so, and it's very enigmatic, actually. But what comes from it is a strong Messiah concept, which pays to learn more about. It would be great if I had more than an hour to do these two principles. But we don't. But you should look into it on your own more. And there's gobs online, so just look online, right, on all kinds of different websites. I'm trying to look for Torah websites, Torah.org, H.com.
Because I find stuff and it's...
Right, there's stuff that's totally whacked, for sure. I'll give you my business card after then. I have just a list of websites that are good websites for additional learning. I'll just read them out loud. I also have on my website a page of links that you can look up at H.com, Torah.org, Na'aleh.com, TorahAnytime.com, WebYeshiva.org, OU.org, Chabad.org, TorahLab.org, OHR.edu, that's Orsameach.edu, Jewish Virtual Library, TorahMediaAtlanta.com, NirlaElef.com, 613.org, and then my website, of course, AbiteOfTorah.com. Those are all kosher sites for Torah information that you could pretty much trust.
Okay.
Understanding, and here's an important principle also, in Jewish philosophy, it's okay to sometimes have divergent opinions and hold them both, even when they don't agree with each other. Unlike in Jewish law. In Jewish law, you have to settle on one law because you have to do something. It's either kosher or treif. It can't be both, right? But with Jewish philosophy, we don't know for sure. So it could be both. And that's okay. So sometimes you'll find contradictions, and it's okay to live with the question mark. And that's one of the principles of the Eliyahu cup on the Seder table, is really the cup of Elijah is a cup of question mark. Because really, there's the four cups are poured according to the four languages of redemption that are listed, and I'm not going to repeat them now, but there's really a fifth language too, a fifth word. And the fifth word is he's brought us into the land. But we're not yet in the land the way we're supposed to be. So the question is, do we respect that word? The other four things happened. This one didn't happen yet. What do we do with that? Do we drink a fifth cup or just four? So what we do is we pour a fifth, but we don't drink it. It's a compromise cup. It's a question mark cup. We don't know what to do with it. We call it the cup of Elijah because when Elijah comes, there is what to do with it. We just don't know it. When he comes, he's going to answer the questions for us. And there's lots of questions. So that's a very important Seder cup, which we don't understand that much. But to put a big question mark in the middle of our table on the night that we transmit all of our Masorah, how do you say that? All of our tradition, the key transmission night, to say, we don't know it all. Mm-hmm. It's all known, but not to us. And it's okay. It's okay that we have some questions. So, okay, so that's the thought about Jewish philosophy. Yeah?
Isn't it true, too, because we almost made a big mistake with, I'm going to say his name wrong, Bar Kokhba?
Bar Kokhba.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That now we're even a little more hesitant.
Well, it's not just him. And I don't think he's the most hesitant one. I think the one that's causing us greater hesitancy right now would be Shabtai Tzvi. So Shabtai Tzvi. So what we're referring to is false messiahs along the way. So we have a clear concept from our sources that there will be a human, no more divine than me and you, but everybody has a divine spark, right? But a human being who will be a charismatic leader, who will likely be wealthy, wise, militarily strong. So wealthy so he can't be bribed. Wise so he's smart and a good leader, a good orator, and has won wars so that he has the military capacity also, and learned in Torah. All of that put together in one. Right? So that kind of a leader who will be able to move us forward. So we have this strong concept that there will be a human being like that. We've had a lot of mistakes along the way. It's interesting to look at early Christianity. So that was certainly a mistake along the way. Although, there's an interesting Gemara that I recently saw, I think just last year, where it says that Paul, who is the main publicist, right? He's the one who really got Christianity off the ground, was actually an observant Jew who, and this Gemara says, who secretly infiltrated Christianity in order to make sure that its philosophy would be divergent enough that it would become its own sect and not part of the Jewish family.
Oh,
isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Josephus is still a question mark. You know, the way that we understand what's true and what's not is by looking behind us. Right? And that, so like Rambam, lots of questions when he was alive. Now we know for sure 100% acceptable. Right? Josephus is still a question mark. Yeah. We still don't know really. So we definitely take a lot of what he wrote as history, but we don't count on him for philosophy necessarily because not totally clear on whose side he was. But that he recorded history that we can rely on, that we do know. So it's interesting to see him as a personality and that he remains in the question zone. Okay, so that's the concept, that's the short concept of Messiah, is that totally human being, not divine in any way. There may be such a human being in every generation waiting to be activated in a way. Like if the generation merits, the person's there. They don't have to first be born and cultivated. There is somebody born and cultivated in every generation that can take it on. We are permitted to believe that our rabbi is the Messiah, or will be, or could be. Like as soon as the activation comes, that it could be our guy, right? Which is what Bar Kokhba was about, right? So Rabbi Akiva, one of our top sages, believed that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah, much like Chabad believed that their Rebbe was the Messiah. The right thing to do Jewishly is to believe that when he dies, he isn't. Right? So so that's how right. So that's where we know Bar Kokhba wasn't, and that's where we have a little divergence with some of the Lubavitch movement today, because some believes that he's dead, so he's not, and some is not so sure, which is what happened with Shabtai Tzvi. Right? So when Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam, so his publicist, I don't know the name of his publicist, but his equivalent of Paul said, oh, it's just a test. Just testing you to see if you're still going to be faithful. And so many people were still faithful. And then when he finally died, still, they said, it's just a test. He's coming back. So we can't really understand it. But just so you know, statistically, it will help with the impact. 1/3 of European Jewry had actually sold their belongings and was ready to go to the Holy Land when the call would come from Shabtai Tzvi. So basically, most of European Jewry believed he was the Messiah. And 1/3 had already taken concrete action to follow him. And so it was devastating when he converted and then when he died. But because there was such widespread belief, it did hang on for a few decades after his death. So much like we still feel some of the ripple effects of the Holocaust still 60 years later, it's still alive. It's still a force in our lives, weakening, but still palpable. So Shabtai Tzvi's influence was still a force in the lives of European Jews this much distant from his death, which actually caused ripple effects, let's say, for instance, on the life of the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who wrote several books that I teach and learn from, one of them being The Way of God. But his books were initially, he was seen as too charismatic for comfort. So in the wake of a false messiah, he was seen as a possible new false messiah. Like, people were nervous. And so the rabbis banned some of his teaching and his learning and his books and sent him away from Italy off to Amsterdam.
Does the messiah claim himself a messiah, or is he claimed? Other people say
it's a good. We don't know for sure how it's going to. It can't be that. So we do know for sure that when the Messiah comes, it's going to be as clear as day. And that's the expression that's used, meaning it's undeniable. There will be no question. Nobody will be behind saying, I don't believe in him. I don't think it's true. There will be nobody who says that. So it'll be absolutely 100% clear. So whether he says, guys, I'm it, and we all instantly agree, or, you know, whatever, right? Can you imagine? Or whether it's conferred, whatever it, somehow, whatever the process is, and I'm not exactly sure exactly what the process will be.
But will non-Jews also see?
Yes, it will be very clear.
Seriously?
Very clear, yeah.
So you told us his characteristics, and what steps do we know when it is being achieved, the process is being achieved?
Well, so we can already see some of it being achieved because some of the prophecies of the Messianic time are already happening. So things like, I mean, we have classic statements that we all know, like beating the swords into plowshares. So what does that mean, and are we actually doing that, and will it actually be swords and will it actually be plowshares, or will it be that we begin to use the technology that we're using for defense for taking care of people? For synergy, for growing enough food for the planet, but even beyond that, for nurturing people and sustaining people. So, and then we see, we know the curses that were given to Adam and Eve. You know, if we talk about the curse, so whether it's periods, whether it's giving birth, whether it's eating food by the sweat of your brow, so all that is being lifted, certainly in the modern world, not that we all live in the modern world, but we do in this room. So whether there's Advil for period cramps, or whether there's epidurals for giving birth, or whether there's modern hospitals, or whether we're working as information age workers and not actually literally sweating, you know, and whether, you know, look at all the healing that we have all around, how illness is being lifted, and so many things. Yes, there are other illnesses too, for sure, but it's just the world is changing. And even though we just lost a granddaughter, I was thinking about the other granddaughter. What if she would have been born 100 years ago? Or what if she would have been born today on either side of our border? You know, on either side. She might not be here, right? So it's amazing to think what we have. Either if she was born in Mexico or Canada, right? Mexico or Canada does not have the same health care as this country does. Right, so this country has health care that's available, but it means that health care is available, really. It exists. For all human beings on the planet, can all human beings access it? No. But have we accomplished a level of knowledge that could bring us to a place where we really don't have to experience so much death and suffering and even aging and whatever it is that we experience, right? So all of those things are slowly being lifted. And even the synergy, right, the fact that in the end there won't be, nation won't lift up sword against nation, okay, we're not there yet, but we definitely have a lot more cooperation than we ever had. I mean, cooperating for space research or for other scientific research, you know, and the whole concept of open source software is now, people are saying, should be applied to science or even applied to law, open source contributions and synergy where borders don't matter. So all of those things are little twinklings of messianic energy that are beginning to appear now, and it's going to get stronger and stronger. So, and even the fact that we have enough food on the planet to feed everybody is just poorly distributed or politically impaired. You know, so which it is, right? I mean, you've got kleptocrats, you know, who are stealing food out of their nation's mouth when we have enough food to feed them, whatever it is, all that stuff. But the ability to spread it once, really it's just brains in the way or egos in the way. Once that can be lifted, the planet can be healed. So we're, but that wasn't the case 200 years ago. So, but it is the case now, and we're moving more and more into that now. So those are all parts of the Messianic Age starting to sprinkle backwards now, and as we move forwards towards real synergy, towards everybody working together and recognizing and one God concept. And it's interesting even to think about, Maimonides talks about what is the role of the Christians and the Muslims in the world. And so he postulates that it's to spread the word of one God. Even though they spread it by the sword, even though they spread it by coercion. But the truth is, the bulk of the planet today, because of Christians or Muslims, has heard the concept that there is, whether or not they believe it, but has heard about the concept that one God rules the world, gave us a book that has information in it about how we should behave because of that. And most people have heard that. So it's not going to be foreign when there's a revelation of a one God concept where everybody, like we say in the end of Elenu, on that day his name will be, he will be one and his name will be one. He's already one, but we don't see him as one. His name is already one, but we don't call him by one name. So the God concept is all going to come into alignment while everybody will see a oneness of vision, not the narrowness of their perspective.
And is the Messiah going to show us light, show us how to view it a certain way?
I think so, but I think it's going to be through talking, because we as Jews believe in the power of education, and we believe in the power of all of our brains to be able to grasp concepts. We just need to be open to it and directed towards it. So I think there will be more of an opening of our hearts and minds, and then we'll just need direction, but it will be also become very clear. Right, so one of the messianic prophecies, or one of the things that will happen, is the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord. Right, Malach al Haaretz Dea, the earth will be filled. So, and it's not just knowledge, but that kind of knowledge. Because we have, as Jews, we have a lot of words for knowledge in Hebrew, but that kind of knowledge that means total connection. It's the same word that's used for "and he knew her," for the sexual experience in marriage, where it's not a euphemism, it's coming to know somebody so deeply that you blend into one. So it's that kind of knowledge with God that we seek, where the knowledge becomes so strong that we blend our minds into the thoughts of God.
If we're getting closer and closer to this messianic time, how do we understand things like the Holocaust, where, you know, we move so far backwards and so many things that were, and so many people died. I mean, how do you make sense of things?
Right.
Like that?
So you have to move back from thinking that you understand that it's moving backwards. So I'll just give you a tiny little example, which, again, it's only parables. But so I was talking to somebody last night who was saying how stupid blogs are. They're so stupid. Who wants to read that somebody just picked their nose last night? I'm thinking, you're saying that, but you don't really know what a blog is, right? That's not what people are writing. You know, they're not, maybe some people are tweeting things like that, and some people are updating their Facebook statuses on the least little thing, I just had pizza, but even most Facebook statuses are not updated that way. It's sometimes a thought, or at least the Facebook people I see, they put a thought, but a blog is usually about somebody's process. Now, maybe it's a process of Julia, right? And she wants to do all of Julia Child's recipes, and it's her process of how she cooks them all, but it's process. It's not just silly information. So I was thinking, this person has such a narrow view of blogging that they can't see the value at all, right? So that's the parable. Such a narrow view that you can't see the value at all. If we have such a narrow view of what God's doing in the world, then we can't see what's actually going on. So what we have to know now is just that we don't know. And that there's a purpose, and that it's good. That's all we can really know. Now, with that in mind, we can wonder what was going on. What was God thinking? Right? So we could get stopped in the angry place. God runs the world, and he made this happen, so he must be horrible. That's not a God I could believe in. Or God runs the world, but he lost control, so God must not be all-powerful, because the God I'm thinking about would never let that happen, right? So those are conclusions that some people have come to. But if you can think on a much bigger space, much, much bigger. So if you understand that the Torah is the guide to how to use the world physically to grow ourselves spiritually. That's what it is, basically. And that everything is here. Our body, our environment, our friends, our lack thereof, our money, our lack thereof, our society, our law, our lack thereof, whatever it is all here to provide the arena for us to exercise ourselves spiritually. Then you can say, what's the exercise of this? How do I grow through this? How do I grow through the Holocaust? How do I grow through a raise? How do I grow through losing my job? How do I grow through a difficult neighbor? Right? How do I grow through a death in the family? How do I grow through a difficult child? How do I grow through a fabulous child? Right? Whatever it is. Right? I just spoke to an interesting bride yesterday, a newly engaged girl, who is from a famous Jewish family. And she got engaged to a non-famous Jewish family. So so it's just interesting to think about the fame of it. And she was saying how so many other famous Jewish families wanted their sons to date her. But she chose this one. It's the right match. It's a good match. Very nice match. So I was just talking to her, giving her some perspective that there are famous families out there. And in a way, some of those desirings to date her were really about kings wanting to match their prince and princess for alliances. Not so that's really what we call a pants skirt shidduch. You know, right age, opposite genders, let's match them up. Right? Except for in this case, it's majesty. Right? So right age, majesty, let's match them up. I said, but this, what you have is a real match. Right? So how can we understand how things work? I forgot exactly where I got there. right. So we just have to expand into understanding that there is a place that we're going and we don't necessarily understand what God's doing. So how do I grow through that match? How do I grow through being a child of majesty? How do I grow through being a child not of majesty? She asked me how I feel. She said, can I ask you a personal question? I said, sure. She said, how do you feel about yourself that you have three children who aren't observant right now? So I told her, at first I felt really bad about it. And then there are a few different thoughts, and I explained how I felt about it. And she said, well, it's all schus avos anyway, if they'll be religious or not. It's all the merit of our forefathers. I said, I don't have that. You know, like she was dismissing and saying, don't worry, it's forefathers' merit that's going to make that happen. I said, as a convert, I don't have that. You know, I don't have any merit of my forefathers to put into my children. You know, but she does, so it's something she's confident in. She comes from a from forever family, so she's got merit of her forefathers that's going to pour into her children. So there's this, so how do you grow through not having that? How do you grow through having a lot of that? Everything's about how do you grow through this. So if you can see life much bigger, now the risk of seeing it so big is it could lead to complacency. It could, right? It could either lead to a lot of push and power, right? I want to do as much as I can to grow as much as I can through this, or it doesn't really matter what I do. In the end, it's all going to be good. And I don't feel like I'm happy being mediocre, and so I'll rest and be mediocre. No, so it could get to that place. Another risk of seeing the much bigger picture, if you really pan back and you really can hold the bigger picture, is dulling of emotions. Because then pain is not as painful. And joy is not as joyous. Because it's all about how can you grow through this. Right? So sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it's not. So that is a con of getting the bigger view. But I think it is still worth it to get the bigger view and just be careful of the cons. You still have to be there with people. So let's say you merit to achieve some of the bigger view. One of the bywords in Judaism is to worry about your next world and the guys next to you, this world. So meaning you never tell your spouse, you know, if you want to achieve merit in the world to come, you should. No, you say, what would you like for dinner? How can I make you happy right here, now, in this world? And you are working on your spirituality while you try to attend to their physicality. Right? That's how it is. So your spiritual path is your spiritual path, and you try to attend to the other's physical comfort. So you worry about your olam haba and their olam hazeh, right? Your future spirituality and their present physicality. That's how we're supposed to behave. Which doesn't mean there's not wider things to consider. Of course, there always are. Okay.
The cure to complacency, though, is you, for me, is teachers. Because then you don't become complacent, because if you consistently learn...
Correct. So that's not teachers, that's you. So I'll quote Zig Ziglar, who passed away this week.
Did he really?
He did.
Oh, okay.
So he said, and I cut this quote out of the Wall Street Journal a bit on him, inspiration is like bathing. It doesn't last, which is why we recommend it daily. Isn't that great?
I like that a lot.
As long as you have appetite.
Right. Right, right. So that's what's really important, is to move forward. Zig Ziglar was a famous inspirational speaker, and he's actually credited with making that into a profession. So he was in his 80s, but he did business speaking, and he started out as like whatever, some poor, shoemaker's kid or something like that, and turned into some fabulous, famous, turn the world over kind of a guy. So I don't remember other things about him. I've heard his name, but I read his obit. It's one of the things I learned from, I forgot from who, maybe even from a graduation speech. Read obits, because you learn a lot about somebody and how they change the world when you read obits.
Reads the obits daily.
It's good. You learn about people, and you learn about how they influence the world. It's a short biography. So you learn a lot about slices of life when you read the obits, right? It's an important thing. So I try to do that. Even in the IJN, they're not always such big slices of life, but I feel like here are some Jews who passed. I could spend 3 minutes honoring somebody I didn't know by reading their obituary. Like, it's just a way to connect into the Jewish people and read about whoever she is, where she was born, and who she married, and how she died, and now I know.
But I'm still mulling over that, what you said about your family, but you don't believe that your grandparents and great-grandparents, who were good people and produced your mother and you,
for sure,
that they had wonderful merit, and just because they weren't Jewish, they doesn't mean
correct.
That
that's correct. So I don't have right. So you don't know what this vote that you have is. So first of all, I do, and every Jew does, whether or not they have religious family back generations, we all have our matriarchs and patriarchs, which are merit for us. So we definitely have that. But then I do have my own merit in my parents, and I think about it, for instance, just in the merit of my grandparents, who were not the most Jewish friendly, and they weren't the most Judaism friendly, but they were they weren't the worst either, but they weren't the nicest. I found some letters of my grandfather who didn't say the nicest thing. I mean,
he was a product of his time.
He was a product of his time. So if you could see it in that, he was a product of his times, but he was a chemical engineer and he developed plastics, and he had some words about some other Jews who were in the biz. So anyway, it's interesting and sad to see that. On the other hand, I have Ezra Stiles, who's a huge Judeophile. So he's there in my family history. But the more I read about his Judeophilia, it was more about how Christianity is right and how could he love Jews enough to bring them into the truth. So there's that too. So it's fascinating to see all of it. But meanwhile, so talking about those grandparents, it's interesting for me to see that they merited, and I think I mentioned that in this class, they're the ones who merited to pay for me to go to Israel. I mean, I earned some of my own money, but I couldn't have stayed as long as I did without money that they gave me for college. And my father did not give me for college. So my father did not merit a share in this teaching. And my grandparents did. You have to merit to give your tzedakah dollars even, or to give your inheritance dollars to the right causes. Some people give them to the wrong places. Right? I mean, that's what Esther Wien was talking about with all the mess in the flooding with Sandy. So here we all are collecting so much tzedakah and working so hard to restore what we had yesterday. You have to merit for your dollars to go in the right place. So all of us Jews now together are working so hard to restore what we had rather than to build our schools and move people forward. We're just trying to get back to where we were. So she's talking about meriting. What causes you to merit to be able to spend your money correctly or not, right? So I was talking to my husband about some business thing he wants to do, and how he feels strongly that we need to, you know, make sure there's enough money for Jonah, our grandson who has Down syndrome, or for Yoshua, our son-in-law who is in a wheelchair, like that we should be able to leave money for them. I said, that's not up to us to leave money for them. You know, it's really, we have to daven that Hashem will allow us to leave what we can leave, but really Hashem can make total differences. Like, we could leave millions of dollars and Jonah could need tons of care. Or we could leave hardly anything and Jonah could be really healthy and high functioning and not need all that money for tons of care. Right? And the same thing, I mean, there's all kinds of, Mashiach could come in a week and everybody will get up out of their wheelchairs and walk and be healthy. And like, and anything that we'll do to outside of what's normal to earn money won't be necessary. So we do have to know what's the appropriate amount of time to work on earning money and the appropriate amount of time. Like, you don't have to give up your learning time to earn money. You should have your personal avoda time, your personal connection with God time, and not give that up to earn money because you don't know if you're going to need that money. Like, how money works. It's not up to you. It's up to God. So, yeah.
So you just said something that kind of brings back to Mashiach. Everybody will know when Mashiach comes. Because magical things are going to be happening. When we say magical,
they are.
Magical, but, you know, God-related stuff. Can you go into that a little bit more? Because, you know, it's hard. I remember I studied this before, like, isn't there a different opinion of whether actually metaphysically things will be different in the world?
Yes, there's difference of opinion. And that's one of the differences. That's one of the differences of opinions that we can live with. We don't have to solve that right now. So we'll just hold those differences of opinions. But let's say that it seems like it's magic. I mean, I don't know about you, but this is total magic. You know, like, I could just slide my finger across a piece of glass and then talk to somebody on the other side of the world in real time. And I can text them a picture. I could take a picture of my granddaughter and just hit send, and in a few seconds, my friend in Israel will have that picture. It's nuts! And we all live with this, you know, like those Star Trek doors that you went, you know. So some wealthy guy wanted to put them in his home. So he calls up the studio and says, who made those doors? I want to install them in my house. And they said, who made those doors? We have two stagehands pulling them and pushing them. It's a total fake. We just put in a sound effect. It's stagehands doing it. So they didn't have that technology. Today you walk towards a door and it opens to greet you. You know, like, it's crazy what's going on. It's just amazing. We live with magic everywhere. Right? We give ourselves a little shot and it protects us from, we take a sugar cube with a drop of purple stuff on it and we won't get polio. It's amazing. There's magic all around. So whether we see it as magic or whether that's just our perception, it's still amazing, and that still is a sign of Messianic age coming. Okay. That leaves us just a few minutes for resurrection. That has not happened yet. No. So what is the concept of resurrection? So the concept of resurrection has to do with the It Matters section of our 13 principles, these last four principles of It Matters. So what matters here is our body. Our physicality matters. Right? It's not just that we're a Hulk carrying a soul and that we're going to completely shed it and then go on. It's that the two work together. Our soul can't do anything without our body. Right? And our body is worthless without our soul. Right? So they have to be together. So the common parable that's used, that's given in the Talmud, is a blind person and a lame person see luscious fruit in an orchard. Right? So the lame person sees the fruit, but he can't go get it. Blind person can go get it, but he doesn't see it. So the lame person tells the blind person, put me on your shoulders and carry me over to that orchard. I'll guide you and we'll get the fruit. Right? So they go and they steal a bunch of fruit and they eat it and they're happy. And, you know, they fall asleep under the tree separately. Right? Now the owner of the orchard comes over and says, you guys stole my fruit. So the lame guy says, what are you talking about? I'm lame. I can't reach it. And the blind guy says, what are you talking about? I'm blind. I can't see it. So he says, wait a minute. And he makes the lame guy get on top of the blind guy. He says, ah, right? Together, you did it. So that's the parable that's given for body and soul, right? Soul is the one that directs, but can't do anything without body, body is the one that does that. But if we'll be totally separated, then the soul can say, I didn't steal that. You know, that was the body. And the body can say, I didn't have the desire for that. That's the soul. Right? So then how can you... So there, for reward and punishment, which there is consequences for what we do, for both good and bad, we have to be put back together. There has to be the concept of together. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean like people, some people think that it's going to be a getting up out of the graves and walking out. That's a question. In the Valley of Dry Bones, it's interesting, that's a resurrection prophecy where, or it actually happened then, where the first the bones rattled, and then the sinews attached, and then the flesh attached, right? So that's an interesting thing. How does it work? So that's a question, really, if you think about it. How will resurrection take place? Will it be like birth, like what we have now, conception, where we start out soft and mushy, right? And in the middle of the mush, the flesh, we then grow structure inside that strengthens it and you come out a human being? Or will it be the opposite process, starting with structure, just the bones, and then things are attached with the mush added on the outside? So it'll be from hard to soft or soft to include hard. What does that mean? So those are the physical questions, but it certainly parallels a spiritual question too. I can't answer that question for you because we don't know the answer of how resurrection is going to happen. But we do know that we prepare bodies at death for resurrection. That's why we do a tahara. That's why we're totally against cremation. That's why Hitler was totally into cremation. He absolutely understood. I want to burn these bodies so they can't rise again. Now, it turns out resurrection's a miracle. So it's going to happen no matter what. Even if somebody got burned, even if there was a terrible car accident, even if they were in a fire and somebody didn't burn them on purpose, whatever it is, they're still going to get resurrected if they deserve that. But because it is all a miraculous process, but we are still responsible to do our part. So our part is to do a tahara, wash the body, get it ready, and then plant it appropriately. So what is resurrection like? It's like, in my opinion, and this is just how I see it, my parable is a tulip flower from a tulip bulb. They're totally different. You take a tulip bulb and slice it in half, you don't see a flower. And a bulb doesn't look pretty at all. But if you plant it and wait, something comes up that's the same physical stuff as what you put in, but it's totally different. But it's 100% related, right? So that's sort of what it's like, and that's one reason why we have bulbs and trees that lose leaves and look dead and come back to life. We have a death life cycle to get us used to death life, that it's not, neither one is a solid end, and that, and that when you plant things, new things come up. So when we bury, we know that something related but new will come up. So again, will the graves open? Probably not. But is there going to be a physical thing that is somehow related to the physical things in plural, because we're all reincarnations. What does that mean? Many carnes, right? Lots of fleshes. This soul or chunks of the soul has inhabited different hunks of flesh. Somehow that's going to have to all coalesce into one physicality that then the soul will be dropped back into, and together that physical body will be able to be transformed by the soul at that time to much more physically reflect the spiritual level of the soul. So it will be, I sort of see it like Alka-Seltzer, you know, being dropped in, two tablets, right? The soul's dropped in, fizz, whoosh, change, right? So when the soul gets dropped into that physical hulk that is the resurrected hulk, the soul, when the soul drops in, that's when the transformation's going to come, and there is going to be, the physical will then represent, will then reflect accurately the spiritual level. Yes?
So where does this new physical take place? Is it on our planet? Is it somewhere else?
It is going to be on this planet, but it's the very beginning of the next world. So eventually we're not going to need this planet anymore, but that actual resurrection is a physical resurrection here. And then our sages diverge into two major camps, if there will be a second death or a shedding of that body, or will it be a transformation of that body into an eternal, not needing to eat or drink, but still physical body that works with the soul.
Will there be any resemblance of the physical of somebody's current physical and how they resonate?
Probably not too much is my guess, but it's a guess only. Because my understanding, and I do want to do more research on this, but I did speak to somebody about this, bless you. A common question that a lot of people have is, when they die, bless you, will they see their relatives? Right? I had a friend who converted, and her father died when she was a child. She wanted to know, if she converts, will she ever get to see her father again? Because being raised, her mother always taught her, your father's waiting for you. He's in heaven, and when you go to heaven, you're going to see your father. So that was a question when she converted. Is she giving that up? Will she see him again? And many people do look forward, right? Do look forward to seeing their relatives again. And we certainly have these near-death experiences where people do see their relatives. So what's up with that? So it turns out, it seems that the first layer or the first experiences of death, because it's a process, you do see that. You do come into contact with those who loved you, who you had strong experiences with, whatever. But that our personality, even forget our body shape, for sure our body shape, but even our personality and sense of self-identity is a garment that eventually we won't need. So that will be shed, but at a higher level. So that there is an initial phase which leads to comfort, and so, but there are phases of growth and development after death that are triggered here in life, but that do continue to go, the ripples continue after death. So here's where we set them into motion, but they continue to go on the other side through the processes that they need to go. So eventually our sense of self that we have, our own personality, will no longer be necessary for the rest of the journey. Sure. Okay, I guess we'll end on that spot. Thank you very much.
Again.